It's a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Joel Finkelstein from Memphis, Tennessee. And he's been the rabbi of the Anshei Sfarad Beth El Emet Synagogue in Memphis since 1997. Even though, as far as I know, Joel is an Ashkenazi, he likes the Sfaradim because he previously served as the assistant rabbi in the Spanish Portuguese Shul in New York. So he, and I know when he was serving there as the rabbi, he would talk about all the Sephardic minhagim that, of course, he observes and he picks up. So and, it's a pleasure to welcome him. We know each other, I guess, a little bit from the Yeshiva University, and it's nice to be able to connect online. He's been serving the community there for 23 years. And Bakashev, Rabbi Finkelstein, we look forward to your shiur.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. And I thank you, Rabbi Cohen, for being invited back. I guess it's a good compliment. I spoke once before and here at the Torah Motion. So I'm happy to be back again. And it's wonderful to see the wonderful crowd that you get from all around. So welcome to one and all. And thanks for taking your time to study with us. The it always intrigued me that the story of Avraham saving his nephew and basically conquering the entire Israel to save his nephew is not prominent in our education for our children and for our own memories from childhood. My memory of that story is that there were five kings, they were fighting four kings, and I couldn't understand who was on which side, and it's hard to remember. And yet, really, this is such a remarkable story that there were five kings fighting four kings. Five were the local ones. I remember that because sort of they were the little city states in Canaan. It was the hick town, and they were fighting against the four major powers, including Hammurabi himself from Babylonia and the north, and they had been submitted to their authority, and then they made a rebellion in the Canaan area, and the northern powers came down to show their force, and when Lot was taken, Avram had to save him. And with that, he was given a blessing by Malki Tzedek, and he had some exchange with the king of Sodom as well. So you ask yourself, here's Abraham conquered Israel. He defeated, with 318 men, he defeated the northern major powers. And this is not the major story that we focus on as for Avraham. All we can tell about is the tent, how many sides his tent was open on. Isn't this a remarkable story? So it made me wonder, how do we as Jews and throughout the centuries, how do we feel about Avraham the warrior? Now, I know that last night, Rabbi, help me out, Jay.
Sokolov.
Rabbi Sokolov. Sokolov. Many years. Yeah. Rabbi Sokolov spoke about Avraham the warrior from the Haftorah perspective. We will mention Haftorah briefly, but we want to look at what are the rabbinic attitudes throughout the centuries, the Talmud in the medieval period, more modern period, toward Avraham as a warrior. Was it valued that he won this war? So let's take a look. Let me share the screen with you. Rabbi Kelman, if you could just help me get there.
You should be able to share. You are the co-host.
Okay. Great. Here we go. No problem. Terrific. Okay. So Avraham the warrior, perhaps not the image we usually picture of Avraham. As some sort of warrior, but if he defeated all these people, he must be some kind of a warrior. So Rabbi David Zvihavim points out that this story, 14 verses where Avraham's not even mentioned, where you're simply describing the battles between these different kingdoms, it's the only story outside of the outside war in Genesis or in the whole Torah. Who cares? There could be major wars that went on during the, let's say, the period of the Book of Kings. We don't even record them. We don't even talk about them. We could care less about the history of different kingdoms and who won and who lost. We're only interested in things, says Rav Meidan. The Torah is about our relationship with God. Anything about our relationship with God, we record it. We started with Adam. We ended the special relationship we have with the Korban Havayis. And that's the only thing Tanakh covers. Since there's no Nevuah anymore, we're not interested. It's not in Tanakh. What is this doing here? Well, you have a story of Vayibra Me'er Raphael, Me'er Shinar. We have the Hammurabi, the king of Shinar, Aryoch, who's from Elasar, and Kedar LaOmer, he was from Elam, which is a Babylonian kind of a thing, and Tidal Melech Goyim, this other king, and they made a war against the locals, the Set, Sodom king, the Amora king, the Adma, and Tzvoyim, and Soar, the five places where were eventually destroyed, he made a war against them, and they went on and they fought in different places. Who cares? What are we talking about this? So we have two questions tonight. One is, what's the rabbinic attitude, the Jewish attitude toward Abraham the warrior? And number two, what's the point of this story altogether? The Rav pointed out an interesting thing, that Avram is forced to choose between a culture of hedonism, who's that? Sodom and Amorah, and one of power. Power, the northern kingdoms were surely very, very powerful. And which side is Avram on? He's actually on the side of Sodom and Amorah, which is our first question that should strike us. Why is he saving Sodom and Amorah? Who saves Sodom and Amorah, right? It was like the Gulf War. We saved Kuwait, but we saved Iran, right? That's what we basically did. We had all these casualties, so Iran would be the greatest power in the Middle East. So what is he doing? He's saving the hedonists. And says our Salvagic, Avraham realized that he's on no side. I once heard a talk from who wrote the book, The Prime Ministers? The Prime Ministers.
Avi Nair.
Yes, he spoke in our shul, and he spoke in our shul once, and it's the whole story about him. And he said that Israel is amazing. We have no natural allies. Everybody's got an ally. You have the Asian states. You have the African states. You have Muslim states. You have Christian states. You have European states. What block is Israel part of? We're not going to join the hedonists. We're not going to join the power hungry, the Machiavellians. So where do we belong? Where are natural allies? And he realized that we have no natural allies. So that's an interesting lesson. If we ask, what is this story all about? It's about how there's this war. And you ask yourself, what's the point of this? Who cares? And the answer is, we don't care. But you're stuck. You're sucked into all kinds of swirls of history that you have nothing to do with. And you get sucked into it because you're there. There we are. It's like, if anybody knew the Woody Allen movie, Zelig, and no endorsement of Woody Allen here, but Zelig, that he was this character that any point in history, he was always there. And there, at any point in history, we're always there with all these great powers, and we have nothing to do with them. We have nothing in common with them. But there he is. There's Abravanel with Ferdinand and Isabella. He has nothing in common with them. He's stuck with them. There he is. So that's one point of what this story is doing here. Now, when Avram actually enters the scene of this 14 verses, it says, Avram heard that his brother was taken captive. He mustered his retainers, his students, his soldiers, his slaves. He was a rich man, so he had 318 servants, and he used them to, by your dofa Don, he chased them all the way to Don. It's an anachronism. Don was not called Don until later, but he chased them all the way from, he lived in Beersheba, went all the way to Don, which is, those are the basic borders of Israel. He went all the way up. So he went all out, and he saved them. So there we have it. Avraham HaGibor. It's Avraham, the great warrior, who leads the troops. And with 318 men, what does that remind us of? With 300 men, he was able to win the battle. Who does it remind us of? Gideon.
Shimshon.
Yaakov Gideon.
Gideon.
Right. Shimshon was one man show, but Gideon, with only 300 men, he could defeat, was it 3,000 or 300? But anyway, he did not use a larger number, he used a smaller number. There's a lot of similarities between Gideon, who destroyed the idols, like Avraham did in the Midrash, and Avraham HaGibor. And in fact, you had Torah, and sure, very excellent lecture last night. I'm sorry I didn't have a chance to look at all the materials or listen to it, but we read the Haftorah of the Shabbos, Mi Yirmi Mimizrach, who stirred things up from the east, because Avraham came from the east. Tzedek Yireg Raglau, at his feet is justice. Tilfanav Goyim, in front of him, the nations fall, and Lachim Yard, he's sovereign over the nations. Tenka Farkach Harbo, his sword is like dust, like dirt. So what is his business that his sword is like dust? So Rashi says there in Isaiah 41, Rama ke'afra kitulin kadam charbe, that he lifted up this like dirt, the the destruction, or with a sword or something like that. That he natan et charbov asoseh chalim rabim kafar. He takes his sword and he's able to make many many fallen soldiers like dirt. Ve'et kashtonatan marbe harugim. He with his bow and arrow, he was able to have many many who fell. Right. So, but this idea that he fought like dust is alluded to in a wonderful story of the Nachum Ish Gamzu in Sanhedrin. The story was that he wanted. They said, "Well, who's going to bring a gift to the Caesar, to the emperor?" So they said, "Well, Nachum Ish Gamzu. If anything happens, there'll be a miracle and he'll be saved." So he goes. He takes his box of gold. He sleeps over at a hotel for the night. The hotel owner steals his box of gold, puts dirt in it. He goes to the emperor. He says, "Here's my wonderful gift from the Jews." He opens it up and there's dirt in there. They're about to kill him. And then Elijah the prophet came and appeared to them as Nahum's traveling party. And Elijah said to them, Eliyahu Navi said, "Maybe it's the earth from the earth of Abraham, who would throw dust and it became swords. And it would throw straw and it became arrows." Remember the straw from the verse before, the straw. So they examined the dust and they discovered it worked. There was a nation that they couldn't conquer. They took the dirt, they threw it at the other nation, and it turned into swords and they destroyed all the nations. So it's interesting. You have an idea that Abraham fought in a supernatural way. Not only do you have a midrash that 318 is actually the gematria of Eliezer, and he only used one person, not 318, but he only used one soldier, namely Eliezer. But even if he used 318 people, he fought in a miraculous way with dirt. What's the significance of dirt? Why dirt? What's the association with Avraham and dirt? Afar. Right? He said he was Afar Va'efer. Avraham is very modest. Later on, he's going to say that he's only Afar Va'efer. He's only dirt. So somehow this very humble man is the great warrior. And maybe it's his dirt that his nothingness can conquer whole nation. So it's interesting. It's interesting. Okay. So there's a modern commentator in the Encyclopedia Mikra. Encyclopedia Mikra is a wonderful book. We have to be open to the fact that it's not Frum. It's not religious at all, and they have different perspectives. But sometimes they say interesting things. So, for instance, they said Zehim Non L'Avraham. This is like an anthem, is singing the praise of Avraham. That's what this story is. Mufia b'tor gibor nadiv. He appears here as an amazing and benevolent kind of a hero, who ravid riv achalash miad haritz. He fights the fight of the weak, right? From the strong. And he has the highest soul of someone who's a great warrior. So this modern secular encyclopedia thinks that Avraham is portrayed here indeed as Avraham the warrior. I asked a question, is it really Avraham the warrior? Is that the image we have? As Jews, I thought we were taught of Avraham as chesed, he's kulo chesed, he's the man of chesed, he's a warrior. So then despite the being great, written in Hebrew, written in Israel, they say, sure, he's a Ramatkal, he's the head of the army, terrific. I don't have any problem with that, that's great. There is a medieval French commentary, it's in the Likud Michachmei Tzarfat, Bereshit, it's on Al HaTorah, there's Amraphel, Kol Zeh Perish, La'agid gulato shel Avraham. The whole story here is to say the greatness of Avraham. She'elu heim malchiyot echriv kol malchiyot shumoneh. All these v'achakach nitzcho elu chamish malchim. In other words, these five nations were never able to defeat the four nations. And with Avraham's help, he was able to defeat them. That's why this story is here, to show the greatness of Avraham. They don't say the word gibor or hero or warrior. But they say that the point of the story is that he, look how strong he is. He could do that which the five kings couldn't do. He did it. He repelled the five nations, the four nations. Hoil Moshe is an interesting commentary. It's from an Italian rabbi, 19th century. A little bit on the modern side, very interesting. So he says, Achar kol gvurot ha'ela, hafach orif, hu v'chol chilo lifnei Avraham. After all the great thing, the conquests of all the 14 verses of how the northern kingdoms were doing so well, Avraham and his 318 people, they come and they make them run away. here's a little twist. The Encyclopedia Mikra'it was saying that he's a real warrior. That's what we're interested in. He's a warrior. That's what the story is. He's a warrior. So he says, and the French medieval commentary said, yeah, he did a great thing. He was able to, it's a great miracle. He defeated all these people. But the Hoyle Moshe says, well, the point is not that Avram's a great warrior. What's the point? L'Hashem ha-milchama, that to God is all wars. You don't need a big army. You could have two people. You could have Eliezer. If God wants you to win, and Asher Yachpot Yoshia, whoever God wants to win, they will win. So really, Avram the warrior? Is that the image we have of Avram? Does this look like Avram the warrior? Is that the image people draw of Avram Avinu? Well, Reb David Zvi Hafman doesn't like it at all. And you think David Zvi Hafman's a modernist. He's a 19th century German rabbi. But of course, Germans were very little bit anti-Zionist or non-Zionist. I don't think David Zvi Hafman was guilty of that, but there was an element of that there in Germany. And he says, "B'ta'ut choshvim rabim," with the great error, many people think, they think the point of this story is to show that he's a great gibor, he's a great hero of war. No. There's nothing farther than from that in anything in all of Tanakh. Really? You mean David's not portrayed as a great warrior? I don't know. You think the Torah wants to portray its heroes as heroes of war? And you know who's gibor, you know who's a hero, someone who does God's will. Look, not warriors who are stuck in blood. What is the point of the story? It's all to tell the kindness. Our first grade teacher was right. Don't tell the kids about this war. Tell them about Avraham's kindness. That's the important thing, that he wanted to save his nephew, even though Halani fragmented him, even though Lot was a no good Nick, he left Avraham. He does the good because he wants to do the right thing for his nephew. He doesn't care that the nephew is no good. He's not looking for anything for himself, etc., etc. And he says there's another point, Derech Agav. Lot, Amnam Chashav Ki Bachar Makom Moshav Ashir Poreh. Lot thought he got a good deal. He got the best real estate in Israel. And it was like Gan Hashem. It was like Gan Eden over there. In the end, he got in big trouble and he had a terrible time. And he had to be saved with this old uncle that he thought was, you know, some kind of a hermit or something. In the end, he has to thank his uncle for everything that happened. Okay. And he says, it's also interesting how Israel was a place of desire, that from the beginning of history, everybody wanted a piece of the action there. And we know that it's a passageway from the Middle East, from the Fertile Crescent, through the Mediterranean, to the Greeks and the Italians. So we know that it gives you access. So many different points. So David Zvi Hafman, number one, he totally rejects the notion of Avraham the warrior. I think that's ridiculous. Torah doesn't make that point. What is the point? To show his kindness. It's an act of kindness. And also to show wickedness, that the futility of trying to live a hedonistic life. In the end, you need the rabbi to save you from your own nihilism. And also the notion that the land of Israel will always draw attention from others. I see we might have some comments here. Let's see what we got.
No comments yet, really. You can wait till the end of the comments.
Okay, fine. Okay.
And one moving comment.
Okay, we'll move along. Wait a second. So then we ask, was it even a good idea? I mean, he's got 310 people against four major kings. It's a very dangerous kind of thing. How could he get involved in this? How could he even do this? Is it a good idea? So Rav David Zvi Hafman says, Warrior. Who cares about warriors? You think we're interested in portraying people as warriors? Number two, was it even a good idea to go into this war? Like people in America, we always question the Iraq War. Was it a good Vietnam War? Was it a good idea? So Mayor Spiegelman, was one of the fellow I knew from B'nai Akiva. But anyway, he said, If Avraham had stayed out of the war, everything would have been great. The northern kings would have taken Lot, the no goodnik, and Sodom, the no goodnik, and thrown them out of Israel. Avraham could have marched into the beautiful Gan Eden like a Jordan Valley. He could have lived there like the Mashiach would have arrived. When Avraham took the people that God had exiled from the land and he brought them back to Sodom, he forfeited the opportunity to inherit Sodom as his place. Said the Canaanites are not sinful enough to leave, so they're still there. The Sodomites, he brought them back. So where is Avraham going to live? Because of that, Avraham learns in this parsha that he's going to have to go into exile, leave Israel, and come back because the Amorites are not sinful enough to chase them out yet. So Meir Spiegelman says, not only do I not like the idea of Avraham the warrior, you know, you could say we did a good job in Iraq, we did bad, it was a good military victory. The whole thing was a big mistake. This is a story of Avraham's huge mistake. As we'll see later, there's support for this in the Gemara as well. Now, some say that there are multiple messages, one of which is good old Avraham with his open tent and lots of chesed. By the way, the Bedouin tent is closer to the open tent than other tents. The Rambam says in the Morning Vuchim, 350, that it comes for several things. Number one, a few undisciplined men who were not trained warriors defeated four mighty kings. That's number one. How Avraham sympathized with his relative. That's number two, we mentioned that before. And he exposed himself to dangers of warfare in order to save him. And a third point we had not mentioned, how contented and satisfied Avraham was at the end of the story. He doesn't even want to take a shoelace from the king of Sodom. He does the whole thing for nothing. He's only doing it to save his nephew. So we learn about the great miracle. He doesn't put it in miraculous terms. Oh, he does. He says, at Hanes, it was the miracle. That's an important word there. So the miracle, again, it's about God. It's not about Avraham the warrior. It's about God, the miracle maker, who helped Abraham win with just a few people. So again, it's not a warrior thing. It's more of like Gideon, miraculous victory. That's the Radak, who's all the Provençals are very much influenced by the Rambam. They love the Rambam. They're the ones who didn't reject the Rambam often. And he says it shows, number one, trust in God, that the few could beat the many, as we say in Chanukah. So it's about trust in God. It's again a little different twist. It's not about his greatness. It's not about the miracle. It's about how we trust in God that despite the bad odds, as we pointed out over here, right, the odds were against him. I wouldn't bet on it. He still won because he had trusted in God, and one should sacrifice himself to save a relative. So that we saw before. So Radak's new idea is about trust. So here we have Avraham the faithful, not Avraham the warrior, Avraham the faithful. The Rambam had Avraham the kind person who sacrificed himself for others. Through Al-Bad says that it teaches us midot. He's always interested in what could you learn about, you know, how to behave, proper character. You should never lift your eyes away from people in your family. I had a funeral today of somebody. The brother had to pay for the funeral because the brother had nothing. You have to take care of your family. Even if the relatives are not behaving properly, they're your annoying Aunt Matilda, you still have to save your Aunt Matilda. You should always help them, strongest hand possible. So now you might say, what kind of society is this? Everyone has to help their relatives? Is that a good morality? After all, we should be universalists. We should save people in other continents. That's what we should do, right? He says, no. The way toward a moral world is for people to take care of their family, their city, their country, etc. Ultimately, that will help the collective kibbutz, the medina, it will help the country, it will help the collective if everyone would take care of their own. And this, I think, is a very important point, that as Jews, if we could just continue to model for the world, you take care of your own. And if every community would take care of their own, we'd be in very good shape. So I think it's a very important point. One modern sort of Haredi commentary says, how can we help the wicked? After all, Lot was wicked and Sodom was wicked. How can you help them? He says, well, Lot is his student. He's his pupil. He came with him from the old country. If this is his fate, that he dies and he's taken captive and he's tortured, then it ruins Avram's reputation as the one who brings good to others. So he had to save him to save his reputation as a Rosh Hashiva. Look what happens to the Talmidim. They get sold into slavery and he doesn't do anything. So he didn't save him for himself, according to this Haredi commentary. But rather, he saved him for the cause. Rabbi Soloveitchik said, what do you mean, why did he save him? He had to save Ruth's ancestor, right? The Mashiach is being born over here. You can't let Lot die. Lot is your brother. Every Jew could be the father of the Mashiach, right? He said he doesn't keep Shabbos, he doesn't keep kosher, he doesn't do this. He said, yeah, he could still be the father of the Mashiach. There's no question about it. When we talk about the idea that Avram, you know, was amazing, he saved his relative, we have to realize that here the Torah is emphasizing a very important mitzvah, which the Rambam describes as Pidyon Shvuyim. The Rambam, in one paragraph, it's very uncharacteristic. In one paragraph, he says twice, "Ein lecha mitzvah rabba ke pidyon shvuyim." There's no mitzvah gedola or rabba. There's no greater mitzvah as big as the redeeming the captives. So the Rambam believes that redeeming captives is an amazing mitzvah, and that's what this story is about. Why don't our Sunday school teachers, our first grade teachers, tell us more about this story and emphasize why this is the greatness of Avram? Forget the tent. This is the greatness. Often they should make little toy soldiers and show the war. And don't bring the kids home with the little tents that they come home with. Bring them home with the toy soldiers and show that Avraham is the warrior and he saved his nephew, because one of the biggest mitzvahs is Pidyon Shvuyim. So maybe that's the value of this story. Another possibility is that it's a lesson about the wicked. We saw that. Who said that? We saw that before in the Rambam. We saw in the Rambam, where was it? Who talked about that? About the wicked, that with the people who are prone toward hedonism, eventually they fall. It's also a lesson about anti-Semitism. Kind of mentioned that before, that the notion that Israel would attract a lot of attention in the future, right? That people would come to Israel and want to attack Israel. The Christians, the Muslims, everybody wants, the Turks, even Hitler and Machshimo, everybody wants a piece of the action in Palestine, right? In the land of Israel. So we talked about that. And here's another one, a lesson about anti-Semitism. The Tzora Mor, that I once spoke about in Toronto when I was in Toronto once, only there twice, but I spoke about the Tzor HaMor. He was a Spanish exile. He finds a rabbi job and he's living okay in Portugal. And then, of course, they converted everybody in Portugal and he has to escape. But before he escapes, he buries all his books they had worked for years on, and he buries them under a tree, never sees them again. He has to wander from place to place. It's a terrible story of Tzor HaMor. I was going to talk tonight about another topic. If you're interested in the Tzor HaMor, take a look at what he says about Hagar. He has a lot to say about Muslim persecution for Muslims based on the Hagar story. But in any event, he says, what's the story here? It shows you that pri rishaim nefila, the fruits of the wicked, is that they fall, right? Because the people were so wicked in Sodom, they eventually had a terrible fall. And then he says the following. Zonim lechama loy ta'ala b'sibat Avraham. The whole reason for this war, it's not an outside war. You see, when Davidowitz wrote the book, you know, The War Against the Jews, that the whole World War II is really about the Jews. You say, wow, that's crazy. No, it was really about economics and money and politics and this fascism. He said, no, it was really about the Jews. He said, really, is that possible, a war against the Jews? And here you read these verses and the Northern Kings and the Southern Kings, and the Five and the Four, and you say, what is this all about? And you say, you know what it's about? It's not an extraneous story. It's all about the Jews. He makes a claim that's very midrashic. He says, you know why he fought against Sodom? Because he heard that Avraham lived over there, and they knew that Lot was over there. So they came specifically to attack against the Jews. It's a war against the Jews. Now, again, whether this is a good reading of this story, I mean, I would question that. Is it a good reading of history? I think very often the question of the Jew is behind a lot of headlines in the world. After all, it worked. They attacked Lot and Avraham came out. It was really a war against Avraham. It was really a war against the Jews. So it's an interesting idea. It's a lesson about antisemitism. It's a lesson about wars and about world history. If you want to stick with a more holy image rather than the warrior image, here's another image. Avraham, the highly respected, as God had promised. Who's that? The Ralbag, in another idea, says it shows you the stature of Ma'alat Avraham, the stature of Avraham in that land. Even though he was a ger, right? He was a stranger in that land. He didn't come from, he was a Hebrew, came from the other side of the Jordan. He had tremendous respect. The king of Sodom and the king of Malkit of Jerusalem, Shalem, came to greet him. And nobody would eat until he did. And with that, Hashem shows that he fulfilled his promise. So again, it's not just about Avraham, how prominent Avraham is, but it's about how God keeps his promise to Avraham. And again, as readers of Tanakh, we always have to think, is this story is about this on the human level, and what's the God lesson? So on the human level, oh, look, it's nice. Avraham, our ancestor, had all this prominence. But the God level, it's saying God fulfilled his promise that Avraham would have a great name, Agad Lashemecha, as we say at the beginning. However, going back to the theme of Meir Spiegelman from the Kohn Herzog, there is this Talmudic idea that Avraham made tremendous mistakes here, that Avraham, the warrior, whether we like the warrior or we don't like the warrior, the whole war was done in a wrong way, according to the Talmud. There are some major mistakes in this war. Let's take a look. The Gemara in Nedarim 32a, Amar Rabbi Baba Amar Lazar, Neiman Enash Avraham Avinu Mishtadu Banav Mitzrayim, Atayim Veser Shanim. Why was Avraham punished? The end of this story, shortly after this story, two stories later, Avraham is told, oh, by the way, you're going to be slaves for 400 years. What did I do to deserve that? What's wrong? So he says, you know why? Neshasa Anegraya. He made a draft against Talmud scholars. Now, as Rabbi Meidan pointed out, one would think that this would be a great source for Haredi Jews, that in Israel, again, not all Haredi, but some Haredi Jews in Israel who don't want to fight in the army, they could say, you see, if you draft scholars like Avraham's 318 students who were great scholars, if you draft them, it's tremendous punishment. You don't draft scholars. But Rabbi Meidan says, and that's a simple read of it. Meidan Yeshivat Har Tzion, my Rebbe, he said, wait a second. If you have a good war that's being fought for a good cause, so of course you should join it during the war. Even the bride and groom should leave their chuppah and go fight the war. But it wasn't a good cause, because what happened? Avraham gave it all back. Right? They conquered Sinai Desert and then they gave it back. So then what was the point of it? I don't know. That's a different story. But if you conquer something, you give it right back. So then what's the point of it? And if you, so it's not that he drafted them for a good cause. That would be fine. But if you draft them for a bad cause, shame on you. What are you wasting your time for? Well, we care whether Sodom controls Israel or whether Amraphel controls Israel. Who cares? Let Amraphel be in charge. We're Jews, we don't care. So that's theory number one. Theory number two and three. So one is not related to our topic today, that Avraham in the end of the Parsha questioned God. Maybe that's why he was punished. Okay, Rabbi Yochanan says that it goes back to this story. Sodom, the king of Sodom, says to Avraham, look, I'll take the people. I want to be in charge, and I want to help them live their nice hedonistic life under my authority. And you can take all the money. So Avram says, I'm not taking any money. What about the people? He doesn't take them either. So he says, wait a second. Avram is the soul maker. Avram's the guy who makes all these souls and he brings them under the divine wing. So here is, he has the entire country from Dan, from up north, and from the Golan Heights down to Beersheba. And according to Rav, as we'll see later, according to Rav Meidan, even from this Transjordan, he has all these people, and they're under his tutelage, and they all owe him a great debt of thanks, and they belong to him, and he just gives them to the king of Sidon. What is he doing? He stopped all these people from coming under divine wings. He forgot his whole mission. He conquers it. Great job. God promised Israel to Avram, and he gave it to him, and there it is in his hands, and he's got all the people. And he could continue the great yeshivas that he had set up to influence the thousands of people, the Rambam says, who were influenced by Avraham. And the 318 men, he could add to them all the people of Sodom who would certainly do tshuva now that he saved them. Instead, he gave them all back to the king of Sodom. So Avraham, the warrior, I don't know, maybe it was a nice thing to fight the war, but he botched it up in the end, the follow through. Like the George Bush Jr., the question is, what do you do the day after when you win the war? What's the next plan? What happens after that? And that's where Avraham fails. This notion that Avraham had the whole world in his hands is found in Rashi, quotes the Midrash from Genesis Rabbah, that what? Midrash explanation says, Rashi, Emek Shaveh, all the kings came to Emek Shaveh. Emek Shaveh means it's a flat valley or something. But he says, no, it's a valley where all the nations unanimously agreed. They were shaveh, they were equal. Everyone agreed in appointing Avraham as prince. Here's the Medrash itself. Rabbi Brachi, Rabbi Chanina, Rabbi Shmuel ben Nachman. Shmuel ben Nachman is one of the great Agadic authorities. Shesham hushvu kol v'chavim. All the Gentiles agreed. The Kitzu Avrazim, they chopped down trees. They made a big bima, big platform, a auditorium there, a stadium. They put Avraham top of the podium and they would praise him. And they said, to him, be the king over us, be the Nasi over us, be the president, you be our God. So he says, nah, the world has a king, the world has a God, you don't need me. He had the whole world in his hands and he blew it. He blew the whole thing. Maybe Avraham the warrior, yes, wonderful. But his follow-through was horrific, according to this Midrash, according to this Gemara. According to this, is there anything wrong with Avraham the warrior? Maybe there's nothing wrong with him being a warrior, but he's not good with the follow-through. Right? George Bush asked his advisors, what happens after you conquer it? They said, oh, then you own it, and you have to pay for the plumbing and everything. He said, oh, that's not good. You know, what do we do about that? So it's the follow-up. That's where he failed. Come back to that in a moment. Just one last aside, two last aside. It's some say no. It's about Israel. This is about this war is about the borders of Israel. This is Avraham making a first conquest on Israel. The Gemara talks about the Kedusha Rishona, about the Kibush Rishon. I think the Rabbeinu Chananel talks about that Avraham's acquisition of Israel. That was the first Kibush, the first acquisition of Israel. And Maidan says there are these verses at Hazuzim Baham. He says, you read these verses, you say, what is this talking about? The geography of Haram Seir and the Zuzim, what is this talking about? We'll read the first chapters of Deuteronomy. Where are those areas? Where did this war take place? In Transjordan. The Chori, that's where Esav is going to be. Avraham's grandson Esav is going to be there. The Zuzim are the giants that were conquered on the other side of the Jordan, where Og and his friends end up in northern Transjordan. And in the Golan Heights, that's where they were. It shows that Transjordan is part of Israel. It was not that Abraham simply went from south to north in modern Israel. He also went to Transjordan. It's all about it's all about Jabotinsky. It's all about the two sides of the Jordan. Rav Shimshon Val Hirsch makes an interesting point about Israel as well, and that's as follows. Avraham becomes Jewish. He comes to Israel. His first problem is a famine. Second problem is there's a war. He says, what's going on over here? These are the worst things that can happen to a person. War, famine. He says, Israel is in the Igud HaGamur Shel Mitzrayim. It's the opposite of Egypt. The fruitfulness of Israel depends on God. its standing internationally depends on other people. It cannot hold up against invaders from the south, from Egypt, from the north, from the Fertile Crescent. Land of Israel leans toward famine. It's a borderline. Israel is on the borderline of a desert, by the way. And litlut midinit, it is often dependent on various powers north and south. Its place in the interchange between different roads going in different directions makes it the connecting piece of Europe and Asia and Africa. It led to the fact that all the nations are always trying to get it. It tells Avraham at the get-go, this is going to be tough. You're going to have a lot of people who want to live in this land. There's going to be famines because it's a near desert country. You're going to have invasions. That's the way it works in the land of Israel. It's a very sad and tough message about the land of Israel, according to Rav Samson and Rafael Hirsch. And it's about the future. Why do you have four kings? Anybody know in association with four kings? What do you mean? There will be four kingdoms that will come to conquer the world. And we will be subject to them, the Babylonians, the Persians, the Greeks, and the Romans. And we will be subject to all of them. And in the end, we'll conquer them all. And in the end, we'll get all their wealth as well. As it says in Isaiah, they'll come with boats of gold to bring it to us. That asteroid out there, they'll bring it over to us. We'll have enough money for all the yeshivas. But in any event, so that's Ramban's idea, is that it's about the future. But finally, let's go back to that idea of Avraham the warrior. I want to share with you a thought from a wonderful sefer that I was given by Rabbi Burr. I was in St. Louis for Kelman Dimension was in St. Louis a couple of years, and I worked with Rabbi Burr. And Rabbi Burr gave me a sefer. He was moving to Israel, so he gave me the sefer of some Holocaust survivor. And he writes an interesting theory. It's called the Beis Asher. His name was Asher Zelig Shalom of Dala. That was his town where he was the Hasidic Rebbe in Dala. And they tell about how he was in great joy when the Nazis shaved his beard off and they killed him. He was with great joy. He wanted to do the mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem. And he writes the following. We know from the Book of Kings and the story of, I think, the Isha Shunamit and Elisha that, oh no, I'm sorry, it's Eliyahu and this other woman who had the children, who had a child, and the child died. So she says, Mali Yisha Elohim, Batalaz Kirdavani, Lamita Banai. Did you come here to remind God of my sin? You know why I lost my son? You know why my son died in the field? Because in proximity to you, Eliyahu, we all are a bunch of sinners and we die. When God judges us, when we stand by ourselves, we look okay. We're good enough. But when we stand next to you, we look pale in comparison to you and it kills us. Comes the Rebbe from Dala and he says, Vayidof Adan, you know what happened? He says, we see the Isha Shunamit said to Elisha, maybe I got the wrong verse, Batalaz Kirdavani, you came here to remind me of my sin. When a great Tzadi comes among people who are very low, it makes God wonder, who are all these people around him? And through that, God checks all these people. So when the Tzadi walks among the wicked, he says, there's a great, many lawyers come into heaven against these other people. And he chased them to Dan his judgment. When he chased them, they were all judged by God, and he did very much chovah until they were convicted. All these people were convicted, and that's what happened. But I interpret and the vazen nitzcham, as Avraham marched with his men through Israel, what happened? They all dropped like flies. They were all judged. He didn't lift a sword. He's not Avraham the warrior. In this vision of this pacifist man who died at the hands of the Nazis, right? And this Hasidic Rebbe, Avraham the warrior, you know what his war is? Shalom Aleichem, how you doing? Nice to see you. Have a nice day. And as he's walking, everybody's dropping like flies because in proximity to the great Tzaddik, they're all being judged by God. They're judged until they all drop dead. But so it's not Avraham the warrior, but Avraham the righteous, who with his righteousness kills people by their proximity. So it's an interesting shot. By a victim of the Holocaust, Yizichro Baruch. So finally, what are we left with? Avraham the warrior, is that the image? Doug Zvi Hoffman strongly disagrees. We had Rabag, we had we had some modern commentaries who did we had the interpretation of the Gemara in Sanhedrin that he was a great warrior, he did miraculous wars. Maybe there is such an image. Clearly, many rabbis were not so comfortable with Avram the warrior. Some people had problems with the war itself. Or maybe it's the image of Uncle Avram, the notion of what a good uncle he was to this no good Nick nephew. What a kind man he was. It's all part of Avram's kindness. It has nothing to do with warrior. Or no, maybe he's a Hezdernik. Maybe it's the idea that he's both a man of war and a man of love. Because after all, our job is to walk in God's path, to walk with God. And what is God? God is Ish Milchama, he's a man of war. And God is one of infinite chesed. Kilo Olam Chasdo, forever is his kindness. That's what a Jew has to be, person of war, person of kindness. You have to have both together. It's a very difficult combination, but maybe it can be done by the best of them. And that was Avram. He was able to be both. He was a man of war, like David HaMelech, man of war, and a man of love and kindness. So maybe that's the message. So if we ask ourselves, why were some rabbis so hesitant about Avram the warrior? And how do you feel about Avram the warrior? And do we speak enough about this story? Those are my questions I'll leave you with. If you'd like to have a little discussion at this time or any other questions, I'll entertain them now. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. There are a couple questions, I believe. You want to take a look? You want me to...
let's take a look. Sure, we can take a look.
Let's see. Yeah.
Whatever you'd like.
Okay, you can take a quick look.
Okay, when were there two Israelite states? They were not natural allies. What do you mean? When there were two Israelite states, they were not natural allies either, right? Even Israel itself can't be an ally with itself. It's true. It's a good point. Enlarge the text. I'm sorry. Avram entering the war against five kings. Oh, yeah. I always say 310. Yeah, I'm sorry. It's 318. Yes, 318 is correct. Correct. Very good. And thank you, Naomi N. And... Haredi modern commentary, I believe that was Rav Sternbuch, if I'm not mistaken. Conquering and holding, ruling are not the same in modern times, Iraq. Yes, conquering and holding, right. Right, I think that's what I was trying to say. Yes, I agree. Why do they quote Rav Hirsch in Hebrew? Because it's easier to cut and paste it from Al Torah, right? When they'll put the translation in there, I'll do that. But yes, I could have taken the picture. It's true. Yeah, I also like reading
it. Do Hirsch in German. Yeah, yeah. All right, thank you. Listen, like much of the parsha, like everything in Chumash, Chumash is ambiguous. That's what I spoke about, actually, 2 weeks ago, how ambiguous the Chumash is. It's leading us to multiple ways to interpret the story. It's got strengths and weaknesses. But anyways, yeah, yeah, yeah. Thank you very much. Okay, just next week, just Wendy Amsalem will be giving the shiur. The week after Rabbi Benji Samuels, and the week after Michael Whitman. Well, we'll post it up. I have most of the weeks, not all of them filled up through the end of Shmot. And so as we said, this will be a rotating share every week. We'll get a taste of hopefully a wide variety of people. And I think that's something nice. So I hope you'll join us. And like I always say, bring your friends. Sunday mornings, that's our next year. Rabbi Liebtag continuing his shear on from Cyrus to Lord Balfour, the books of Tanakh by Cheney period and its application today. And then, as I'm sure many of you know, 12:15, just after that, Rav Yosef Tzvi Rimon, one of the leading, Poskim, one of the leading Rabbanim in the, you want to call it the modern Orthodox religious Zionist community, whatever you want to call it, will be speaking on technology and Shabbat, what Shabbat will look like in the future. One of the things he said, like, can you have your robot make, tea for you on Shabbos, or heat up, do some cooking as when you're coming home from shul for you. But anyways, we'll discuss some of the issues both from a halachic and machshava point. Vuzei hashir ya bivrit, kemo shamarti yashir lefamim osim shir bivrit as shashir biyom rishon, and then we'll continue everything with for the week. So I want to wish everybody Shabbat Shalom. If anybody wants to talk, see any questions, now's the time, and be well, be safe, and we look forward to learning with you next week. Thank you. And thank you, Rabbi Finkelstein. Thank you. Say hello, and hope things are well in Memphis. You're an hour behind, right? The night is still young.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's nice to have Rabbi Sampson with us. Welcome to him.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's okay. Right. Very good. Okay.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Okay. Take care.
Our pleasure.
Any last questions?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the other thing where there's a big fight about Abraham, of course, if he made a mistake by going down to Egypt, I just throwing that, that's the other part of the Parsha where the Mefarshim go back and forth, was he right or was he wrong?
Yeah, so I wonder more broadly speaking, whether all these moral quandaries that Abraham seems to get himself into, Hagar, he's criticized by Ramban, by the Torah more. He went down to Egypt, Ramban takes him to task. This war, the Gemara is taking him to task. And you say, what's going on? It's Abraham. And maybe the answer is, this is what happens before there's a Torah. He has no guidance. Even though he has a close relationship with God, without guidance of the Torah, this is the kind of quandaries, this is the kind of situations you get into.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, but I would argue even after we get the Torah, questions like that never have answers. In other words, the Torah tells us how to take the lulav and how to say Kriyat Shema, and how to price objects in their business dealings a little bit. But when it comes to the big, big questions, the Torah doesn't give us direct things. I think, thank God they don't. Thank God the Torah doesn't. We have to figure it out based on the values of the Torah. We have to figure it out on our own.
Right. So some say the Shulchan Aruch of how to run a country is yet to be written, but we're going to get there.
We can't write everything in the Shulchan Aruch. As you know, the Rav said, right? The fifth chelik of Shulchan Aruch is common sense. So you can't write everything down. You know the famous comment of, I don't know, the Dor Ravi, his unbelievable introduction to, the Dor Ravi is the great grandson of the Chatam Sofer, the Moshe Shmuel Glasner, died in 1924. Hungarian rabbi, they threw him out of Hungary. He was too Zionistic, too modern. But he has an introduction in his, he wrote a book on Kulim, calls it Dor Ravi, because he was the fourth generation from the Chatam Sofer. And he has an unbelievable introduction there, where he writes about that the Torah, as we know, is meant to be oral. It wasn't meant as a written tradition. It's a tragedy of Judaism. After the destruction of the temple, we had no choice. The Torah would be forgotten. The Torah should not be written down. The majority of the Torah is supposed to be Baal-Peh. So without getting into all the things, but his basic point is that that's to allow flexibility in the Torah. Once you write something down, it says in the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, that's the end of the discussion. The Torah Dafka did not want that. The Torah understood in every generation there are new challenges, new issues. So we don't want it written down. We don't want a permanence to the Torah. The Torah's got to be Baal Peh. It's got to be passed down. When we went into exile, we had no choice. So we had to write it down. So the Torah basically froze. That's, Jacob Katz's argument, et cetera, et cetera. But now that we're back in Israel, he's writing this, I don't know what year he wrote this exactly, but let's say the turn of the 20th century, not that we're coming back to Israel, we're going to go back to the old system, we're going to get Torah Shabbat, where things won't be written down. That was his whole idea, his sort of his Zionism. And he was like a very ultra-Orthodox rabbi.
He's still going to bring your Torah values to the question.
Of course, but not everything should be written down. I just think it's such a, we don't want everything to be told. The big questions, that's the Elu Elu, the Torah doesn't tell us. And I think that's what the Torah presents, these stories, is very vague to allow us to see it differently. Because maybe in one generation, we should view Avram as a warrior. And in another generation, we shouldn't view Avram as a warrior. So it's not that we don't care what's right or wrong. What's right in the 21st century may have been wrong in the 19th century and vice versa. So I think the Torah allows that. And that's if we can find the message in the Torah. Anyways, that's just... No, my more than 2 cents worth, but overall comment. If you can feel free to disagree, but you can see the Dor Ravi. It's a
The values are the same, but the application can be different. The application, the dagesh
right, in different generations. We read this story about the four kings and the five kings. We have to figure out what's it telling us today. What's the meaning of the story? That's what we have to figure out. Not so simple. But if you want to read the Dor Ravi's introduction, you can look online. I've written about it a couple of times. Schneur Lyman translated, I think, part of it in tradition. I don't remember when and with volume, but if you look, if you have access to the archives of tradition, you'll be able to find it. But it's a fascinating introduction. I mean, listen, Rav Kook in many ways had the same approach, but from a different angle. Somebody's asking me, but I'll pass on to you, rabbis. Does Rav Kook speak privately about Avram the warrior? He certainly was of the mindset that Hesder was a great thing.
Yeah, I saw that question. You're right. As the evening approached, I was thinking, you know, I need to look more at 19th century people. I need to look more at 20th century people to see, how it's portrayed. Yeah, I would imagine that among modern Israelis, definitely be portrayed that way. Clearly, Rabbi Dan's interested in the geographical parts, but yeah, I'm not sure what Rav Kook had to say about it. Interesting.
Okay. Just anybody have any comments? Feel free to, put in your 15 cents worth. Okay. All right. Laila Tov, everybody, and Shabbat Shalom.